after Kay Burningham's book came out, a lot of people read it right off the bat, and I started getting phone calls and nudges from people to invite her to come and speak to us, and of course, I jumped on it immediately. I think she was the first one that I approached about being on the program this year. Her book is just an enormously important addition to our growing library of books from the ex-Mormon community. And if you haven't read it, it's really worth adding to your library. When I was getting ready to think about introducing her, I thought about a quote that I read in an email a few months ago. And it was posted online by a friend of mine who, in the group we were on, we'd been talking about our experiences about why we left the church. And this is what she said. She said, "So when I discovered all these problems, inconsistencies, untruths, unravelings, and truth bendings, it blew me out of the waters of Mormon." I just thought that was so well put. This could ring true for anyone who picks up Kay's book, who maybe is in that wavering time or maybe has left and maybe doubting their decision. And I would just like to turn the time over to Kay now, for I'm sure it's going to be a very interesting talk. Thank you.
Wow. I'd just like to say that I'm very honored to be here tonight, and I feel incredible energy from this group. I've been a trial lawyer now for more than half my life. I'll be 60 next year. And so it's almost 30 years. Well, I'll be 59 in November. And we always say, those of us who try a lot of jury cases, that you can tell what kind of jury you'll get when you walk into the courtroom and you have your veneer panel in front of you, because there's probably about half as many people usually in a jury trial, especially in California, as there are here tonight. And you kind of, you get a feel for the people, a feel for their energy, a feel for whether they're really authentic, they are truth seekers, or they're just sort of here because they have to be and they were called on jury duty and they want to get the hell out. And luckily, although you do have some people like that, I get a really good feeling, and I'm so happy that this conference has proceeded as it has. I watched the presentations from home. I can't sit all day. I have a neck problem. But I was there laying in my bed and watching on streaming, and I just think it's incredible. And I think the more people who speak about their experiences and put together from their unique vantage point how they see the problems with Mormonism, and we're going to get to the point where nothing can stop what is happening. And I have to apologize. My assistant here is a dear friend of mine, and he's still a true believer, and that just shows that there are still very many good Mormon people. He's a wonderful friend, and he's here to help me tonight, and he's been with me in a lot of trials. And I was joking because he had a big Diet Coke when we drove in. I said, "Don't take that in there, else I'll out you." And that's So I did anyway. That wasn't very nice. Anyway, thank you, David, for being here. And I'll go ahead now that we have the slides. Hopefully it'll be all right. Yes, thank you. You know, I started out as a young defense attorney. And for those of you who've read my book, I apologize. And also, I'm going to make an apology in advance to the members of the bar who are here, because I know there are a few of you here. I don't mean this to sound like a torts class, but I do want to explain some basics about tort law and how it's a little bit different than criminal law. And I'm sure most of you, being the intelligent people you are, know the difference. But it sort of helps to understand the civil law and what our rights are under the law, because it's just not taught in school. And it's not taught in college, really. It's not taught in, certainly not taught in the public schools in Utah. And it should be. We should know more about our individual rights than we do know. But going ahead, the reason I wrote my book was, like all of you, or like most of you, I had felt that, you know, something was wrong. We had been tricked. We had been deceived. We had not been given the whole story. We'd actually been given the wrong story and a misleading story. And for years, I was just sort of put everything on a shelf and dealt with having my two children and my practice. And then all of a sudden, it just sort of came to me that, you know, this is a fraud of immense proportions. This is something that is very similar to other frauds that we've realized have happened, especially in the last 10 to 15 years. And I think just the United States is becoming more aware of what has happened. It's out there more. People are more concerned. People used to not even worry about it. And as I was saying, when I was a young defense lawyer, I used to try insurance defense cases. And it was easy because I was 27 or 28 and I was healthy and I looked younger than I was. And I just look at this person, they're fine, they're faking it. And juries would believe me. And then I had the, I'm sorry. Can everybody hear me? Is that better now? Okay. Thank you. Then I had this car crash on I-15 when I was 36, and it changed my perspective. And I realized that people weren't faking it. I did a lot of personal injury defense, and that there's a lot to cases that actually go to trial. Tort reform has been a big thing in the news as well. I don't know how many of you have heard of the hot coffee case, the McDonald's coffee case. Okay. Most people, and maybe I'm talking to the wrong audience here, but most people, when they hear about that coffee case, they think, oh, that's a prime example of a frivolous lawsuit. But I just want to introduce this by, hopefully I'm doing this right, quoting something I did quote in my book, and this is from a German translation. Propaganda brought us into power. Propaganda enabled us to remain in power, and it will enable us to conquer the world. In the 80s in California, tort reform is really getting hold. And as a defense attorney, it was good for me because I was able to convince the juries that these plaintiffs go and try a case and they shouldn't be here and they're malingering and they just want, you know, a jackpot and they don't deserve much money and blah, 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 blah. And then I became an injured plaintiff, and I was on the other side, and I saw that, wow, you know, this neck pain isn't going away in 6 weeks. And the chiropractor really did help me. And I saw all the things I'd argued against and realized that there's another perspective. Well, in the McDonald's case, that was the poster child, for lack of a better word, for frivolous litigation. And for years and years and years, the case was tried, I believe, in 93 or 94. And that's just after I started doing plaintiff's work. And this woman, her name is Stella Liebeck. She was a 79-year-old, and she drove through, let me go through here, McDonald's, which we all know, and ordered coffee. And she ended up getting a verdict that was $2.9 million. And this is in an Albuquerque jurisdiction. Then after that, the press went wild with the coffee, okay, the coffee litigation. And it was billboards. It was on Seinfeld. It was everywhere making fun of her. You know, spill coffee, win millions of dollars. It was a big joke. And finally, about 2 years ago, one trial lawyer and some other people that are affiliated, I believe, with the American Association of Justice got tired of the facts being misrepresented. And they there were even the Stella Awards was something that one guy came up with. I think he was a Colorado journalist who got a hold of a bunch of different frivolous lawsuits, he thought, you know, and would email them out and show just how ridiculous our jury system was. And it turns out that a lot of these things were just urban legends. They weren't even documented. There was no source, no court, no, they were just made up. And so he finally, in 2012, withdrew the Stella Awards, and they are no more. But for so long, people and juries really believe this. And it's so funny how a soundbite can carry forward, and your jury, every jury trial I had, I would have to, during voir dire, ask the potential juror, have you heard of the McDonald's case? And then you would be able to excuse certain jurors because they were just innately prejudiced because of that case. Anyway, to get back to what really happened, because I think this is important in introducing my subject, This DVD came out, Hot Coffee, 2 years ago, and it's very excellent. It was an HBO documentary. I recommend watching it for more information about the truth about the case. This is Mrs. Liebeck. She died at age 91 a few years ago, but she was 79 when she brought the case. And, excuse me, I shouldn't have done that. I meant to have a disclaimer. You're all finished eating, but people thought that what she had done was just a silly little lawsuit. But actually what happened is she was in a car with her grandson, who I believe is seated here. And they pulled over to the side of the road. She put the coffee between her legs for a minute, which was her mistake, and put her cream and sugar in, and it spilled. And it caused her, and if anyone doesn't want to see, these are very graphic pictures, please go ahead and leave. I'll give you a minute. But it caused her third-degree burns over her legs, and it was really terrible. And she had to have skin grafts. I mean, they were horrible. And this is the truth of the matter. And what happened was that McDonald's historically kept his coffee at a really, really hot level. It was between 180 degrees and 190 degrees Fahrenheit. And the plaintiff's expert testified that at that temperature, people, if it's on their skin for more than 2 or 3 seconds, would get at least second-degree burns, if not third-degree burns. And Stella Liebeck happened to have on some cotton jogging shorts, and she was very thin, as you can see, and she had those third-degree burns on her thighs and had to have skin grafts. And what happened also is that in the franchise guidebook, they told their franchisees, McDonald's told the franchisees that they had to have the coffee at that temperature. And what's even worse, during depositions, the risk manager for McDonald's admitted and produced in discovery their own list of 700 prior claims. Not all were hot coffee, but probably 80 to 90% were hot coffee. The rest were hot water, of burns, scalding burns, horrible burns from people who'd been burned in a similar manner to Mrs. Liebeck. Not just something you can put a Band-Aid on, not just something that's frivolous, but serious, serious burns. And with impunity, they continued to do what they did. And so the jury came back, and this was a jury of her peers, and they came back. This is after she made an offer to settle for $18,000, which were her medical bills. No, excuse me, I think it was $20,000. Her bills were $18,000. McDonald's countered with an $800 offer. That was it. And so she went to trial. And the jury came back and ordered that she be awarded $160,000 in compensatory damages, which meant her out-of-pocket medical, her pain and suffering. And then what they did is they decided that McDonald's should be hit with punitive damages. And they gave an award of $2.7 million, approximately. And that represented 2 days of coffee sales for the McDonald's company. So it wasn't much. But the reason for punitive damages, and they're awarded very rarely, and very, very rarely do you get big awards, was to punish and deter the defendant's conduct so that McDonald's would turn down the coffee, would at least have a warning, would do something so people wouldn't be burned like they were. Anyway, so the point is that we all grew up believing one thing, okay? We believe that Mormonism was the one and only true church, and the Book of Mormon was the Word of God, and et cetera, et cetera. And it's funny because I went to a lot of these tort reform. I've been on both sides, the defense bar of civil litigation and the plaintiff's bar. And I've heard PR campaign people speak about the tort reform propaganda campaign as the most successful reform in history because it's taken away individual rights. And people have believed that the coffee case is just a joke. And thank goodness we had this documentary that just recently came out. There's some similarities here with Mormonism. When we were isolated before the internet, before 1994, we had to rely on our leaders, and we had to rely on the books that we had, and maybe we'd get a copy of Fawn Brody's No Man Knows My History. But growing up, if we're children in the church, we didn't see that stuff, especially if our parents and our family were very, very active. But it's all different now. This is just something else I wanted to say about tort reform, is that contrary to what the newspapers have indicated, lawsuit filings are in decline and have been since 1979. Every so often, one of the big journalists, one of the big companies, or one of the big magazine publishers, I should say, comes out with some story about frivolous lawsuits and how there's so many, and people are having to, doctors are having to leave their states and their practice, et cetera, et cetera. Well, in 2003 or four, Newsweek came out with one such story, and the investigation done by Stephanie Mercimer, who's a great journalist and really tries to discover the truth, found that since 1979, lawsuits have declined, tort lawsuits. And tort, again, is an individual wrong, a civil wrong, from one entity or person to another. It's not a crime, as in the state brings an action. So, and then since 96, it's even declined further. So it's just not true. It's propaganda. Propaganda is what I believe the Mormon Church is still engaged in. I mean, anybody can see that when they go to Temple Square and they see the gold plates and they know that, you know, that's not the whole story. This is kind of funny. my topic is fraud in the, are Mormon leaders above the law? And I wanted to look at not only the time of Joseph Smith and the original fraud with the Book of Mormon, but that time and compare it to the contemporary, what I call the contemporary fraud, which is not telling us our true history. I don't think any of you were alive at this time, but in 1835, there was a big hoax that was printed, and it was by the New York Sun. The New York Sun was a New York newspaper, and the sort of ingenious editor came up with this this story about a... He was very vague on how he printed it. He made it seem as if it was a reprint from some Scottish newspaper that talked about an astronomer at the Cape of Good Hope with a new telescope, and he had discovered that there was life on the moon. And so there were six articles in a series beginning in August of 1835 called, you know, the population on the moon, lunar population. And they had the Batman. These were furry men that were out in nature, and they could do all sorts of amazing things. I don't know if this is the source of our current Batman, but that was one thing they had. They had, here's a sketch of him. There's Petillo Homo, okay, the Batman that lives on the moon. Here he is flying. He is very furry. And incredibly, okay, this was believed by many, many people. And, of course, the New York Sun's subscription rate increased, and it took several years before people realized that this was just a hoax and a way to get more subscribers and more readers. And so this was a book that was written about the moon hoax. And a hoax is one thing because, you know, you maybe lose a few cents by buying something that you think is real. Is much different than a fraud. A fraud is where somebody tells you a fact, it's supposed to be correct, they misrepresent the truth of the fact, and you rely on that in changing your position, whether it's in entering into a contract or in sticking with a theology that you believe because you believe that there were golden plates and you believe that this is the Word of God and you believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet. A hoax is one thing, but a fraud is something different. I thought this was quite funny. I'm sure you've all heard of this, but this came out 2 years after, according to a later journal entry. Joseph Smith is quoted as having said, inhabitants of the moon are more of a uniform size than the inhabitants of the earth, et cetera, et cetera. And so, as Michael Quinn has pointed out in his excellent book about Mormon magic, back in the early 19th century, there was a different mindset back then. People sort of had a more vague or blurry line between what was fact and what was fiction. And I think that's really true if you go back and you read any of the sociology comments back then. And it's the same with the law. I did some research on the for this talk on tort, the history of torts. And back then, although there were some beginning laws on libel and slander, the concept of fraud, civil fraud especially, was not really as clear as it is today. It wasn't codified. You're back in the old writ system where if you want to get your horse back or you want to get some property back that you were duped into buying or selling, you had to get a judge to swear out a writ, and then, you know, by force or whatever, you go and use your own wherewithal to get it back. And then if that doesn't work, then you go to the judge. And it was very, very different than it was now. You had writs of replevin, you had writs of trover, you had writs of assumpsit for contract law, but it wasn't codified in one area of substantive law like it is now. And I hope I'm not boring you with this, but I think it's kind of important. So my feeling is that Joseph Smith, while certainly I don't condone what he did, and no one would, I mean, and there are different theories on whether he was just a narcissist or a sociopath or he was just deluded, or whether he consciously was trying to defraud people, and we'll never know because, as Richard Packham pointed out this morning, he's not here. We can't subpoena him to testify, and I have a really good process server, but he cannot find the celestial kingdom, I'm sure. So so we won't ever know. We won't get inside the mind of Joseph Smith, even though there's a really good biography of just that title by a great ex-Mormon psychiatrist. But what I'm saying is that now the law of fraud, along with the law of negligence, has sort of sifted down from some vague, you know, you shouldn't do this, but that you're not really breaking any law, to where now we know what the law of fraud is. And we have since probably the turn of the century, from the 19th to the 20th. And both in Utah and California, which are the only jurisdictions I can really talk about because that's where I'm actively licensed to practice, is very similar on what the law with regard to fraud is. This is just an old treatise showing that it wasn't until after the Civil War that treatises on fraud began to even be published. And my feeling is that the Civil War had a lot to do with it, that the Gettysburg Address and Lincoln and just the horror of the Civil War show that, hey, we need to be better toward our fellow man. And people started becoming a little bit enlightened. Of course, Darwin's Origin of the Species was published in the last half of the 19th century. And maybe the effect of religion sort of went downhill, and it was not as important as some of the scientific philosophies of life. And so there began to be, from legal scholars, treatises on not only torts, but specifically fraud. And all of these started in the later part of the 19th century. Before that, nothing was really written about them. Then what happened is that at the turn of the century, California codified the law on fraud. And this is just to show that that was done then. And here we have a modern-day jury instruction from California on intentional misrepresentation, which is the same thing as fraud. One thing an attorney does, a trial lawyer does in civil cases, is that when you get a case, you look at it and you analyze it on two fronts, liability and damages. And I remember as a defense lawyer, you know, what is liability? Do we have a clear case or don't we? What are the defenses? What are the damages? And you decide whether you want to take a case if the liability is clear and the damages are big. And California and Utah both have a 3-year statute of limitations on fraud, but their elements are very similar. And you can read this, but I'll just briefly say it. Somebody, an entity or a person represented to a third party that an important fact was true. The defendant's representation was false. And when we say fact, that's as opposed to an opinion. Opinions can never be the basis of fraud because people can have their opinion on anything. That the defendant knew that the representation was false when he made it, or that they made the representation recklessly and without regard for its truth, which I think is very important. That the defendant intended that the plaintiff rely on it, and that element can be shown from inference. That's not something that you have to show in a state of mind type of thing, that the plaintiff reasonably relied on the defendant's representation and that the plaintiff was harmed and that the plaintiff's reliance on the defendant's representation was a substantial factor in causing the harm. So this is really clear. This is the Utah jury instruction that is very, very close to the California jury instruction, saying that, you know, people cannot misrepresent the truth of facts. You can't say that Joseph Smith used the golden plates when all the facts are that he probably didn't, there probably weren't even any golden plates. I mean, we don't know for sure, but it was a stone. And the thing that really occurred to me that was very important, I had the privilege of meeting Grant Palmer yesterday for lunch along with Bill Johnson. And Grant, of course, is the expert, one of the experts in Mormon history. And last year he revealed, and I believe that this was revealed a few years before that, but this is the first time I'd heard it. But many of you probably have heard this, that in 1965, as a young man, he was a student at the University of Utah, and Leonard Arrington, who eventually would become the church historian, and back then I think it was a Mr. Clayton, invited him to come up and look at some things that were in the vault, in the church vault. And what they pulled out were the three seer stones that Joseph Smith had, and the last one being the one, the striped one, that he used in translating the Book of Mormon. And when I heard that, I thought, boy, 1965, and when did that come over? That came over with, maybe somebody knows this better than I do, but it had to have been there for years. And I understand that it was in Joseph Fielding Smith's vault before it was in the church vault. But regardless, the stone is the way that it happened. And I never heard of the stone. I know that it was mentioned in the Ensign in the 90s and maybe even earlier than that. But for us baby boomers growing up in the 60s and the 70s, we didn't hear anything about the stone and the hat. And even as a little girl, if I would have known about the stone and the hat, I wouldn't have bought it. That just sounds too corny. I mean, you know, gold plates, yeah, okay. I think there's a difference. And so that's a misrepresentation of a material fact. How do we know that it's material? Well, these are just some more jury instructions. John DeLynn's study, okay, I don't think he's here, but the 2012 survey he made, if you look at this, and I don't know that you can even read this from my slide presentation there, but he lists on page 3 the reasons for people continuing to disbelieve, okay? I used to believe in the church doctrine and theology. I studied church history and lost my belief. I lost faith in Joseph Smith. I lost faith in the Book of Mormon. And you go on down the line, and this might even be the wrong one. But there's a bunch of reasons, and a lot of them are the polygamy polyandry issue. They are the stone and the hat issue. This is, in fact, the wrong section of his study. He has a page in that study where he lists the reasons or the things that really shocked people out of, caused them to look and caused them to decide to investigate this further. And a lot of them were the things that were misrepresented, such as the stone and the hat versus the golden plates, or the Joseph Smith being a monogamist versus the actual facts that he was a polygamist. Things like that, the Book of Abraham being the word of Abraham versus from the Egyptian, you know, from some Egyptian papyri. So all those things were important to the people in leaving the church. And to me, that's sort of a reverse causation. Had the church not misrepresented those important facts, people might have left or might not have joined. And so there you have an explanation of how important and just how damaging misrepresenting facts are. Let's see. Let me go back to this here. Anyway, what I'm saying is that I believe that what the church leaders do now is worse than what happened early on. Because we have the law. We have fraud. It's codified. If you look back, even in Utah, the elements of fraud, the cases I have here, but they began in 1967 that lead to this jury instruction. And if you look back in the early part of the 19th century, even though social Darwinism had not, that term had not been coined yet because Darwin hadn't yet written his Origin of the Species, it really was a time when everybody, you know, looked out for himself. And caveat emptor, you know, or emptor, you know, buyer beware. And the strong, the tricky, the clever person won. And he wanted everything. You know, if you were more strong, if you were more intelligent, if you were more cagey, then so much the better. And in fact, back in the early part of the 19th century, people used to believe that accidents and injuries were just bad luck. And because people were bad people, they had bad luck, and that's what happened. This is before the broad concepts of negligence and duty and well, maybe somebody didn't act up to the standard of care, and an ordinary, reasonable man wouldn't act that way. So these sort of concepts evolved over time, and we didn't have those concepts back in the early 19th century, but we do have them now. And we're learning that so much of what is done is behind the scenes. So much of what is done is not with our consent, whether we're members of the church or members of the United States or however you want to put it. And transparency is emphasized now. And I think the religious leaders also have a duty to emphasize that, even though they want to hide behind the First Amendment. So let's look at now what some of the things are that are recent in religious fraud. I don't know if any of you heard about this, but I just had an email from a friend about the French appellate court upholding a conviction, and I believe it was 2009, for fraud against the Scientologists. And yeah, that was really cool. They were fined 600,000 euros, I believe, and unfortunately there's a glitch in the law where they're still allowed to preach in France, and I don't know what's going to happen with that. But that's a big step. The French, it's my understanding, and if any of you can correct me if I'm not speaking correctly, please raise your hand, but that Scientology has not been allowed or has not been considered a religion in France for quite some time. That's not true with the Mormon Church. Mitt Romney and recently Elizabeth Smart, of course, were missionaries there. So Mormonism doesn't have the same status as the Scientologists do in France. But it's a start as far as recognizing the harm that cults do to people. The case was brought by a young woman who spent $28,000, I believe, in books and things and services, and gave this to the Church of Scientology, and she wanted her money back. She finally found out what it was really all about, and she wanted her money back. So that was really an interesting recent development. Some of the other recent developments that we have in religious fraud, and I'm sure many of you know about this, is in 2008, the church's tax-exempt status was taken away on, I believe it was the UK temple and one other chapel, and because it's not open to the public. And so in the United Kingdom, that was taken away as a benefit that they have. And now I know Tom, like Richard, and like all of you, I'm sure we wish that he would have been here. He's the nicest guy I've ever talked to. He's a son of perdition, I guess. No, I don't mean that, Tom, you know. I mean, but to think that somebody would say that somebody like that is in darkness when all he's done is bring light to the issues in Mormonism is just really incredible. Tom had been working on, and I don't want to say anything out of line here, but he had been talking, I believe, in the United Kingdom about issues concerning the missionary handbook and the benefits that are given to the mission presidents that are not taxable, but maybe should be taxable. There's also a case that is in the news now. I believe it was filed about a year ago in Florida. It's in federal court, and a group of palm readers or fortune tellers who are gypsies have been indicted by federal authorities for fraud. Part of the indictment has to go with their beliefs, and so rightly so, the counsel for the group said that, well, you can't attack that because it's a First Amendment issue. But also part of the deal that the palm readers and fortune tellers had was they told the people that gave them money that we'll give you back your money if you're prediction doesn't come true. If you don't get healthy, if you don't find the love of your life, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, they never did. They just took the money and moved on and to somebody else. And so that is distinguished from religious fraud, whereas you might be entitled to believe what you want to believe. You can believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet of God. You can do this, but your right to believe stops where it infringes upon my right. Okay? And so the secular fraud in this case is that they promised them to return their money, and they didn't. And that is fraud regardless of whether you're a religion or whether you're a corporation or what. Religions do not get a free pass when they're engaged in secular fraud. Okay? So that's something that's kind of interesting to keep our eyes on. The Scientology Church has also been sued a couple of years ago again in Florida by a couple in a case that's similar to the one in France. That's in discovery. That's my understanding. Oh, and one thing I wanted to say about John DeLynn's survey is that he surveyed, I believe it was in excess of 3,000 people, and many of these people were very educated. And it's not as if one of the elements was the reliance reasonable? And some people have argued that, well, nobody really believed the golden plate thing. Well, nobody really believed this and this. You could go out and read about it. I don't think that's true. I think many of us would say, yeah, the way they taught it, they made it sound real. They made it sound that this was something that could happen. And when John DeLynn is telling us that educated people, people with advanced degrees, that this was a big factor in them leaving, the fact that Joseph Smith practiced polyandry or the fact that the plates were translated with a seer stone, that means that it was reasonable to believe that in the golden plates, and it was reasonable to believe that Joseph Smith was a monogamist. And when somebody tells you a fact, and they're your leaders, they're the older men that you listen to in conference, that you rely on as a little child to be your guide and your spiritual advisor, these people, they tell you not to look. There have been articles in the Deseret News. They tell you not to read anti-Mormon literature. They tell you to rely on, you know, what they say. Although things are changing. I mean, if you look at ex-Mormon, I believe it's not ex-Mormon, excuse me, Mormon.org, you will see testimonies and things not of the 15, okay? That's very rare, except for maybe Elder Holland, who even then says, they would not do that. He doesn't say, this is the word of God necessarily, but he couches it in ways that he cannot be hit with being an agent of the church and being, you know, testifying falsely. But what I'm saying is that on Mormon.org, there are members of the church who testify about things, who represent things about the Book of Mormon. But rarely, rarely, rarely do you see the leaders come out and say, this is the doctrine, these are the facts. You have the apologists, but they distance themselves. They're not the 15. And, you know, you wonder, why is that? Well, I think we know. One thing that I do want to say is that I listened to conference, or part of conference, 2 weeks ago, and it's funny, but I was coming back from Los Angeles from a hearing, and in first class, as I walked back to regular class, coach, I looked down, and Dieter Uchtdorf was right there in first class, and he looked up at me, and I looked at him and smiled, and of course, I'm sure he didn't recognize me, but I recognized him, and he was there with a cola drink, or maybe it was root beer in a glass with his, presumably his wife, and he's, I'm sure, I don't mean that to how it came out, I'm sure it was, I mean, I don't know, I don't have the foundation for that, but I would not expect it to be anyone but his wife. Anyway, and when I listened to his talk 2 weeks ago, I thought, this is a really nice, sincere man. This is a very authentic, charming person. And it was really wonderful when he said, frankly, some of our leaders have made mistakes. And I just thought, that's great, you know. But then he went on and started talking about the Word of God and everything. And I thought, you know, it's great to acknowledge that. He has a really good spirit about him. I wish that they could acknowledge more. I wish, but I don't think that will ever happen. We have something that we say as trial lawyers that you usually have to get sued, and there has to be a big verdict before people change. And I've seen this in cases with road design. I've seen it in product liability cases. I've seen it in regular personal injury cases, medical malpractice cases. You will get a way of doing things is done, and it's done with impunity until somebody has to pay. And unfortunately, that's usually what happens. But maybe not. Maybe the leaders are coming around, and I really think it was great what he said. But I have to disagree that any of the things we're talking about were just mistakes. I think when there's a concerted, collective, what I believe is a collusion, to misrepresent the facts of our history, I think that's more than a mistake, okay? And I think that accountability is something that people want these days, and I think that it should be the same in religious cases. One more thing I forgot is in the child sexual abuse cases. This is another example of, well, not fraud necessarily. It is sort of implied because almost all professions have a vetting process. If you have lawyers or doctors, you need to make sure that members of your profession are at least meet a certain minimum threshold of not being convicted felons or of not being bad people. But if you look at the lay clergy in the Mormon Church, there is not a vetting process. It's whoever's inspired, whoever's called to be the leader, for instance, of the young men. And if any of you have read, I'm sure lots of you have read about this, there was a book called The Sins of Brother Curtis that came out after the child abuse settlement in Oregon. And what happened in that case was that there was an older man who had access to young men in the church, and he had molested young men, and there was a history of this, and he kept, you know, being allowed access to these young men. And finally, the case was settled, but only after discovery was forcing the church to open up some of their finances, and then the case settled for $3 million. The Catholic Boston Church Diocese cases, I didn't know this, but the Mormon Church, through its law firm, filed an amicus brief in that case, which means friend of the court, wanting and supporting the argument that churches should be allowed to discipline their own and they shouldn't be subject to secular authority. You know, that's just wrong. I don't think anybody who was instrumental in our constitutional or in our Bill of Rights adoption had anything like that in mind. But it's, you know, it's these things are coming out. This licentiousness that churches think that they can get away with, hiding behind the cloth, hiding behind their clergy, it's just not, people are not going to put up with it anymore. And the way that it comes out and the way that it's exposed is usually not through, unfortunately, journalism, usually through litigation. Litigation is hard. Litigation takes years. Litigation is tough. If anyone were to dare to sue the church, it would take millions and millions of dollars, and at least a decade, if not longer, and you can bet they would fight it. And in the end, though, litigation has done a lot of good things, and it's made cars safer, it's made toys safer, it's made our environment better, it's made road design better. There's a lot of things that people just don't realize have happened because of frivolous lawsuits. Anyway, I know it's kind of late, so I'm going to kind of cut this short. I really appreciate you all being here. And, yes, question?
Are you telling us that you get our tithing money back now?
Well, you know. Yeah, here's the thing. Are we still on the record here? Are we on the thing? What was your second question? I want to get both of you, so maybe I'll answer yours first. It's interesting. I have researched just for my own interest, and actually since I've since this book has been published, I've had several Mormon lawyers and ex-Mormon lawyers approach me and say, yeah, you're right, and show some interest in the very thing that you're talking about, a class action for fraud. There's so many obstacles. There's so many issues, where to file, what law, of course not Utah. There's, you know, although our Supreme Court is wonderful, especially Justices Durham and Nehring, they're all LDS, at least as of 2000. But common law fraud is one possibility, common law cause of action. Also, there's the RICO statutes. And those have not been used for this type of thing, to my knowledge. But they were passed. Those are federal statutes. RICO is a racketeering-influenced and corrupt organization statute that was implemented in the 60s as a way to fight organized crime. And they've usually been used, there are both civil and criminal aspects of RICO, to bring down mafia. But, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say anything more than that. There is an aspect of RICO. Your claims under RICO, under civil RICO, are if you lose property as a result of a predicate act. And one type of predicate act is fraud, mail fraud, which includes now, I believe, internet fraud and television. Another predicate act is money laundering. There are many interesting different things in different ways. It would be very creative and very something that I shouldn't talk about in this sort of forum. But there are a lot of different ways to plead a case where the gravamen, let's say, of the wrong is fraud. And the RICO statutes are one such thing which I believe would allow people who were not preempted by the statute of limitations, and if the case got to the point where a class action survived, that tithing would be one item of damages.
Is that a yes?
Let's see, what did Bill Clinton say? I did not have sex with that guy. I really can't answer this because, number one, I'm not as prepared as I should be. Number two, there are professional ethics restrictions on giving specific legal advice in a forum like this. So I have to sort of back off from that. So if that, I've answered it as well as I can. Thank you. And I'm sorry, what was your question? It was about a class action? What was it? Yeah. Well, of course, a class action is merely, I'm sure most of you know this, but members of a class have to have a commonality, meaning that they were, you know, that they maybe were had the same misrepresentations that were made, or they had the same, they were in the same bus, or they were in the same, for instance, here's a good example. When I was a young attorney, I did defense work for asbestos claims, mesothelioma. We represented Johns Manville, and they were just one of the insurers who, and reinsurers, who had to cover these poor people who suffered from asbestosis or horrible disease that was life-threatening and that killed them. It's not, and the asbestos litigation was so large and so big that from the 80s until the 90s, and it's had a lot of controversy, it finally became multi-district litigation, not class actions, and those are a little bit different. But the theory behind it is that people that have suffered the same type of wrong, whether in liability or damages, and usually it's liability, they're allowed to go ahead and proceed as a class if there's enough identical factors. So yes, in theory, there could be a class action for people who have been defrauded in the same way. And then if their damages are similar, I mean, this is all theoretical, and there are a lot of issues. But that's, in theory, yes. Question? Yeah.
Doesn't the church set, there's been a lot of molestation cases where they come around for the priesthood holder who's a molester. Doesn't the church settle most of those cases if there's any negative...
You know, I don't know the answer to that, and I can't speculate. I don't know. I do know that I have had some potential clients come to me and talk to me about sexual abuse in their wards in Utah, in Salt Lake, that has been intergenerational and systemic. And one young man in particular was on, and I'm not violating any attorney-client because I will not use his name, but I'll give you some broad facts, was on a young men's trip and was gang raped by young men leaders. And, you know, it's almost unbelievable that this would happen. And yet, if you look at the Catholic cases and the other cases that have happened, you know, why not? Mormonism isn't immune from that type of thing. And it doesn't mean that the church leaders condone that at all. And I'm sure they, you know, they've come out saying how they don't. But the problem is when you don't vet or you don't make sure that the people in charge of the young people are not convicted felons, are not abusers of children in the past, when you don't have that check, then you have the risk that you're endangering your children. And that's how the law needs to change. It's kind of funny. I should show you our legislature is a little bit different. There's this tension in Utah between the legislature, which is primarily very conservative and very LDS, and the Utah Supreme Court, which, although they are mostly LDS too and conservative, the two justices I spoke about are very, very broad-minded and very, very, I think, sympathetic to what happens in the state and want to show that we're not idiots and that we're not a theocracy. And this is kind of funny, but in 2008, they passed a, if I can find this here, a law on child abuse, and they specifically exempted, let me read this. I wish I had it to put up here, but I don't. This is, the code section is 78B2308, civil actions for sexual abuse of a child. Thanks. Okay, thank you. As amended, and this is the last subsection, a civil action may be brought only against a living person who intentionally perpetrated the sexual abuse or negligently permitted the sexual abuse to occur, thereby excluding entities, okay? So, but then the Supreme Court, in a case, clarified that certainly our legislature didn't mean to exclude entities. We shouldn't do that. And they said that's just got to be a mistake and that there is a cause of action for negligent entrustment or negligent hiring of somebody who would abuse a child. So there's kind of that tension there. I think it's really interesting. I think many, many leaders in this state want to do the right thing. Yes, question?
I question about what you just said about entities not being able to be sued. With
that's just in that statute.
And using that statute as a basis for I forget the term, but prior legislation, the Book of Mormon states at the beginning that they are published by the Corporation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And as the Supreme Court has ruled that corporations qualify as individuals, could that not be used as a precedent to sue the LDS Church as an individual?
Well, actually, corporate status, corporations have been treated as individuals for years, since the mid-19th century, if not before. So that's not really novel, but that's good thinking. I mean, you know, corporations can be sued all the time, and they are sued all the time. So they do have status as far as comparable to the individual in that they're susceptible to being sued. That's a done deal. That's, you know, been the case for years. As Mitt Romney said, corporations are people too. So in that regard, they are, you know, they can be sued. They can be sued for their bad acts, and they are very often sued. But good insight, yeah. Even though they try to craft out little bits and pieces to cover their butts. Doesn't usually work. Any more questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Is there any way, or has there ever been any initiative to force financial transparency
Yes.
in exchange for the tax-exempt status that the churches enjoy? Should financial transparency be a requirement for
tax? Personally, I think it should. I'm not a tax attorney, so someone here might have a better answer. I don't know if that sort of leverage has been even attempted. Anybody here? Any counsel? Yeah, go ahead.
For us Canadians, it is in Canada.
Oh.
The church financials are transparent in Canada and are for any nonprofit organization.
Thank you for that. And I believe that's the same in the UK, I believe. Any other comments in that regard? Yes?
In New York, that they were not transparent on where they're spending their tithing money. They were successfully sued by their members of their church.
Really?
They required transparency, yes.
Well, I'd like to see that case because that seems like that's not really the law in the United States, although maybe New York has a specific, you know, statute that I'm not aware of. There was a question, yes, comment?
Comment, the question. The comment is I'm from Puerto Rico.
Oh, okay.
union of Scientology and the Catholic Church and the Mormon. One distinction, of course, is that there's a lay clergy in the Mormon.
Right.
Does it offer them special protection, or does it expose them more?
You know, that's a good question. I think it could cut both ways. I don't think it offers them any special protection. I don't think it should. I think it, in fact, exposes them more because they have no training. Certainly the cardinals and the Catholic Church are told not to molest young kids, and they have some training, I believe, in psychology and in sociology. But
nice,
yeah. Rico, you get your attorney's fees, too, and treble damages. Yes.
The short version of my question is there any legal precedent for stopping the LDS Church from using our names after we die? I mean, our names are pretty much our reputation, and in rebaptizing us. And is there a way to protect ourselves from that?
You know, that's really an interesting question, and I haven't thought it through, and I really can't give you advice on that. There should be answers to these. There should be ways to do this. Anything like that would be an equitable remedy, meaning it's not money damages, but you want a court to make a pronouncement to say, you cannot do this anymore. This is not right. This person resigned from the church, and you shouldn't be able to do that. So I would say, in equity, that's something that certainly should be the case, but I don't know of any precedent in that regard. Any more questions? Yeah.
Do you think the lawyers for the church are being proactive when they have disclaimers now on tithing receipts? You see nothing when they change the washing and anointing ceremonies, or are these responses to unknown suits that have been brought that we're not aware of?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. It would be pure speculation on my part. But the point about the tithing receipts is very good. I think it was a few years ago where, and that was, I believe, all over the ex-Mormon forums, where now the tithing receipts are less specific than they used to be and basically have a disclaimer. And you might be able to say that verbatim, that we can use it however we want.
Immediate compensation for your trade of the money. It's a spiritual.
Okay. Okay. Did everyone hear that? Okay. Do you want to...
But they say nothing of substantial exchange was done here.
No quid pro quo. Mm-hmm.
So in other words, they've immune themselves. They granted themselves immunity.
Mm-hmm.
Lawsuit. I want my time.
Right, and I.
Now when you give them the money, you've read that disclaimer and you can't make the claim.
Right, and historically, the law that I've read is that tithing is considered a gift, and you're right, no quid pro quo. So, but I wasn't aware of that particular tithing receipt. The one I was referring to, it used to have specific, this is the missionary fund, this is the publication, Book of Mormon, whatever, and now it's more general, that we'll try to use these funds in the line that you want it to be used, but we can pretty much use it however the hell we want. So
my suspicion is that the whole ceremony, somebody brought a suit who was touched. That's why it was so immediate.
You know, the thing about lawsuits is that, unfortunately, there's so many that almost all of them have confidentiality agreements, and they're sealed. And whether it's, you know, a lot of things are arbitrated, too. And after the case is resolved or settled, part of the settlement agreement is confidentiality. So nobody knows. And nobody knows. That's the problem. Question over here? Did I see somebody? Oh, sure.
Can you give us an idea of the power of the legal department? You have a corporation's pulling in $10 billion a year.
Yeah.
Another $2 in corporate profits and no debt. Is that an opponent beatable in court?
Well, as we all know, Curtin and McConkie has been the church's law firm for years, and I've been up against Dan McConkie, who's roughly my age, give or take, a very nice man in a product liability case. And he's the only one I know personally, and I know that they have outside counsel. They have many, many firms that when the litigation gets really, really down and dirty and tough, they hire outside counsel in the particular jurisdiction to represent them. But, you know, I can't answer that. I really can't. Sure. Oh, sure. Just one more question. Sorry.
Okay. Intelligent people, and we're a small representation of many more of our friends. And I think if we were all to sit here and put our heads together for 3 minutes and say, how much did this table spend on tithing in their lifetime
yeah.
for the church? Bottom line is, what would it take, even if it it's not a winnable case, to be able to bring some motion, some publicity to the idea of this is fraud, this is not a hoax, this was not accidental, this was withholding of information, this was fraudulent. What is the bottom line to get something like that going? So I think that there is a community out there that would be supportive of being able to do this. But as you said, who do you sue, and is it tens of million dollars in 10 years? That, I don't think it takes that much to be able to get the publicity begun.
Well, again, I can't answer that right now, and this is not the forum to do that. I know Jeff Ricks has talked about that a lot, and he might have some answers on that. But, Sue, this man, can we ask his question? Okay, he's been... You know, that's another thing. I can't do that here because I can't... I don't want to have it interpreted that I want to gain monetarily from anything I say. And thank you, Sue. The other thing is, though, is that part of the oath, attorney's oath in the Utah attorney's oath that I took clear back in 85 was to help legal education and help spread information about the law. And that's what I really want to do here, to help people see how things fit together and the possibilities. So thank you so much. I really have had a great time, and I appreciate your questions. Thanks.